Many of the folks out there who have, shall we say, considerable life experience say that they're worried that health care reform might mean rationing or cutbacks in care. But we wanted to drill down on exactly what end-of-life care means. Senior correspondent Maria Hinojosa went to see a hospital in Wisconsin that's been at the center of the debate in Washington over so-called death panels. What she found may surprise you. Brian Epstein produced our report.
On this sunny fall day, 56-year-old Sue Hessel is on a mission here in La Crosse, Wisconsin, to raise money for breast cancer research. It's a cause that matters a lot to her. 3 months ago, Sue herself was diagnosed with breast cancer.
Before my surgery, I was trying to find...
Walking, she says, keeps her spirits up. And Sue has managed to hold on to her sense of humor, too, even when talking to her doctor.
What she said was, because of your ethnicity, we think we need to go a step further and do a breast MRI. And I go, my ethnicity? And she goes, didn't you know that Ashkenazic Jewish women were at higher risk for breast cancer? At which point I go, I'll convert.
Sue? Yeah. Oh, hi. Sue Hessel. My husband, Dick.
Hi, Linda. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Today, Sue and her husband, Dick, are having a meeting with nurse Linda Briggs at Gunderson Lutheran Hospital. It's called an end-of-life planning session. They'll be talking about what to do if Sue finds herself near death.
I work with patients, especially who have serious illnesses like yours, Sue's, or patients with chronic illnesses who may have complications from their illness that could leave you unable to make your own healthcare decisions. I'm going to start with what you understand about your cancer.
First of all, I wish I didn't have it.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
But it's stage 3A. So, and that's because I had node involvement. I had six nodes involved. But they still tell me it's treatable. And hopefully, you know, I'm going to be around for a long time and we won't need this for a long, long time.
Absolutely, absolutely.
That's the goal.
Absolutely. But if we don't plan for some of those events, people get themselves in.
We were granted extraordinary access to conversations like this one that some people are now calling death panels. The controversy started with a small provision in the House health care bill that would ensure doctors are paid for having these kinds of conversations. Opponents of health care reform went after the provision. They began to accuse the government of intruding into people's private decisions about medical care.
We should not have a government program that determines you're going to pull the plug on grandma.
They argued that the goal of these conversations was to deny care to the sick and elderly, all to cut down on health care costs. We came here to Gunderson Lutheran Hospital in La Crosse, Wisconsin, to meet a soft-spoken medical ethicist named Bud Hammes. His program is at the center of the debate.
Some people would say, well, they're about death, and people don't want to talk about death.
Talking and thinking about death and the best way to approach it is what Bud Hammes does for a living. Beginning 20 years ago, he created one of the first comprehensive programs in the country for end-of-life planning. And now he wants to set the record straight.
When you hear these words, death panel, that have now become part of the lexicon, what goes on for you?
Sadness. Sadness because that distortion has created fear for, I think, no good reason.
Hammes says his program is not about denying care. It's about empowering individuals to make choices about their own medical treatment. What Hammes is asking is for people to think about the quality of their life near the end of their life. For example, if you are in a vegetative state, would you want extraordinary measures taken to keep you alive?
Our technology and our medical treatments can do wonderful and amazing things for people. But at some point, the good that they do won't be enough compared to the harm and the suffering that they will inflict. At some point in each of our lives, that balance of doing good and harm will be such that the harm is higher.
It was back in the mid-1980s when Hammes first saw this with patients who were on dialysis due to kidney failure. these patients had suffered complications that caused severe neurological damage, leaving them with little quality of life. The dilemma for the patients' families was whether to continue treatment and keep their loved ones alive or to stop and let them die. Talking to the patients' families, Hamas said the same question always came up.
If your mother could know what you know, and if your mother now could decide for herself, she can't, but if she could, what would she tell us? And they would look at me and say, we don't know. And they ultimately would say, if we only knew. And so as I looked at this from an ethical and a human point of view, I thought, what a terrible place for a family to be, because whatever decision they make, they will always wonder, did we do the right thing?
Hamas believed that what was missing was the patient's voice. So he set out to change that by asking people when they were still healthy about how they might feel when they got sick. He calls this end-of-life planning program Respecting Choices.
Yeah. There you go, and that's a choice. Some people have some very strong...
The program encourages patients to have more extensive discussions, like the one Sue Hessel is having, when they're facing serious illnesses.
Well, first of all, I do have to say, I don't wonder why me. Mm-hmm. I wonder why not me, because I don't think anybody has the right to say it shouldn't be him or her. It's just, you know, we're not all that good that we should think that we can avoid something. But that's true, don't you think? But
over the two-hour-long conversation, we witnessed many emotions. The hardest moment was Sue and Dick delving into their past and the sad story of their oldest son. Matt was 8 years old, dying from leukemia, when they made the decision to take him off of life support.
I think what I learned was that when you don't have a choice, you find strength.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can't help but think about how what you're going through is clearly making you remember that very painful time in your lives,
right.
You guys.
Dick realizes there's a chance he might have to make that same decision for his wife one day. That's why they're documenting her wishes by creating a living will. At one point during the session, nurse Linda Briggs asks a series of hypothetical questions.
If you have a serious complication from your cancer or treatment for your cancer, and you were facing a prolonged hospital stay requiring ongoing medical interventions, and your chance of living through the complication was low, and by low we mean 5 out of 100 patients would live. I'm just going to stop there and ask you to tell me in your own words what that situation means to you, what it says.
Well, it sounds like the condition, I'm not likely to survive, mm-hmm. obviously. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like prolonged misery, potentially. I do wonder how we get 5 out of 100 patients.
Mm-hmm. 5 out of 100 is the general number that's given for
is
low.
Okay.
Now, that may or may not be low to you. No,
I would take that chance personally.
Would
for
you?
Me, sure.
Mm-hmm. To continue.
Yep.
To continue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this is again.
While Nurse Briggs isn't looking for any definitive answers today, the scenario illustrates just how tricky it is to make life and death decisions based on probabilities of what might happen.
I agree with you. I think I'd probably be more in the unsure at this point, because unsure is a say, let's see how it.
I mean, is this a chance to return to consciousness, or is this going to be in a coma?
Right.
Exactly.
Right.
Nurse Linda Briggs points out that she's asking ambiguous questions because that's what these scenarios usually are, ambiguous. Still, Sue tells us later that she finds the conversation not only important, but necessary.
So you think that Americans should be talking a lot more publicly about death?
Yes, I do. But it's not like everybody needs to talk about it in doom and gloom all the time. What we're really talking about
is feeling comfortable when you need to talk about it so that you can live your life well as long as you have it.
So when you hear these terms being thrown about the meeting, yeah, death panel, about the meeting that you just had.
It drives me crazy because I see this only doing good. I see it as an opportunity to prevent some pain in the future. And it is so helpful. And it just bothers me so much that anyone would misrepresent something that is so positive and so good. It's a life panel. It's a life panel about how you want to live your life. It's certainly not a death panel.
Oh, yeah, I grew up in Milwaukee.
Sue's husband, Dick, is a reporter and has been covering healthcare reform for the La Crosse Tribune, the local newspaper in town. He says his wife's illness gives him a unique perspective on the debate that has engrossed the country.
I wonder the people who are just opposed to everything, I wonder what they would be thinking if they were going through something like this.
And it's all happening for you in the middle of this national debate about healthcare reform.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which gives me an unusual perspective. Yeah. I know what it feels like, and I know these people talking about death panels and socialism and all of that. It's all fear.
Fear that the government could use end-of-life planning sessions to ration care and deny elderly and sick patients treatment in order to save money. But Bud Hammes says the discussions aren't about money. They're about people making their own decisions about life and death.
People don't want to die hooked up to machines, suffering from the technology that is was supposed to help them. People are actually quite reasonable about their own care.
And people are going to say, well, it sounds then like you have doctors and nurses, et cetera, saying to people, well, you know, maybe you don't want to spend all that extra money on all that extra care and have all those extra tubes, et cetera. And you know that people are suddenly saying, oh, my gosh, now they want to take me off of all of this excellent medical care that is possible.
There are people who say, keep going. And as long as we know that that is truly what they want, then we should do that. So this isn't an issue about focusing on denying care or focusing on saving money. I would defend a system in which we know what the patient wants, even if that's for more treatment. The purpose is to help people make good choices for themselves that reflect their values and goals, so we don't do too much and we don't do too little.
But it turns out, administrators at Gundersen Lutheran say, the Respecting Choices program is saving money. In La Crosse, about 90% of patients have documented end-of-life plans when they die. Here, Medicare spending on hospital care in the last 2 years of life is $17,000 per person. Compare that to $39,000 in the city of McAllen, Texas. Why? Well, at Gundersen Lutheran, many patients who go through the Respecting Choices program are choosing to spend less time in the hospital. CEO Jeff Thompson says that's great for patients, but bad for the hospital's bottom line.
In the current fee-for-service system, that is a bad business model. But remember, our business is to serve the well-being of the community. We are a 501c3 not-for-profit. Our job is to improve the health of the community.
And sometimes, to improve the health of the community, you need to go into the community. This doctor is making a house call. Dr. Geraldine Brasick is a palliative care specialist. Many of the patients she sees have terminal illnesses, so she focuses on relieving pain and suffering rather than trying to cure the disease. Today, she's driving out into the Wisconsin countryside to visit Holly Coleman, a 77-year-old man suffering from terminal liver cancer, lung cancer, and a progressive heart disease.
Holly and I have had some discussions about his wishes, and so I know that he's coming to a point where he's wanting less aggressive care. And that's the situation where I find it very important to have those wishes documented and in the patient's home. How are you?
How you doing?
I'm good.
You're looking good.
Dr. Brazik knows Holly well. She treated his wife, Erna, who died of emphysema last year. Now she's managing Holly's diseases and his day-to-day pain as it gets worse.
Yeah, I love Dr. Bracey. Mm-hmm. I don't care who knows her. Her husband will probably hear this.
I think Pam helps a little bit too, right?
Yeah, she did.
Holly was an Army platoon sergeant in both the Korean and Vietnam Wars and served 5 tours of duty. He believes his cancer is from exposure to the chemical weapon Agent Orange.
When we were out there in the jungle, when they'd be spraying with Agent Orange, which will kill the jungle, it'd be dripping off of trees just like it rained. And it's very dangerous stuff, very dangerous stuff. And it would cause cancer, and it'll cause it quick, too.
The purpose for this visit is to document Holly's wishes in case he becomes ill at home and not in the hospital, where his treatment decisions are already written up.
If you get sick here at home,
yeah,
and the ambulance gets called,
yeah,
and the question is, would you want them to try to do CPR or shock your heart?
No.
Or put in a breathing tube?
No.
Okay. And so I can tell them on this form, yeah, that you don't want those
things. I don't want that, because okay, that, to me, that's just suffering. You know?
Okay.
Okay. I don't want that.
So if you're already gone, we are going to respect that and let
you
go.
Yeah, yeah. You know, if I have no pulse, no heartbeat, I'm not breathing, I'm done.
Okay.
I don't.
Holly goes on to explain that if he has little or no chance of recovering and having a good quality of life, then he wants no extraordinary efforts made to keep him alive.
Oh, you know, if it cannot be cured, and you determine that it cannot be cured, and your second opinion, it cannot be cured, then I say, forget it.
Mm-hmm.
Let me go. I want my wishes carried out. This is my life, my body, and I want to be able to make decisions about it.
Mm-hmm. And I would tell you, Holly, that from my experience, the vast majority of people feel exactly like you do.
Holly has also explained his wishes to his daughter, Pam,
ready,
who moved back to La Crosse to take care of her ailing parents 2 years ago. She loves her dad, and she worries about him.
My first greeting every morning is, "Morning, Dad, have you taken your pills yet?" And there are times when I think he lies to me, but...
She said, "Dad, I'm going to tell you something you're not going to like." And I said, "Well, what is it?" "You didn't take your pills this morning. Now I'm going to tell Dr. Bracey you didn't take your pills, and she'll put you back in the hospital." Well, I'll try to take them from now.
Pam was initially surprised that her father was willing to confront his own death.
Dad never was going to talk about dying, making plans for a will, making sure he's got enough insurance, because he's invincible. He's not going to die. He served in 2 wars. He was shot. There's no way he's going to die.
Level 9 is as high as you can go on this day.
But when you actually just sit down and talk about it, Pam says, okay, it doesn't seem so scary anymore. And she says, it's comforting to know that when the time comes, she'll be following her father's wishes.
I look at my dad, and of course I don't want to lose him. Sorry. But with the care that he's able to get through Gunderson, it takes the pressure off of me, because I'm not, the lone bobber out there, grasping at straws, trying to make decisions.
Bud Hammes believes so strongly in helping people like Pam and Holly that he's made it his mission to train every resident in internal medicine at the hospital in end-of-life counseling. And now, Hammes is taking his program around the world to Singapore and Australia, and with Nurse Briggs, to a suburb of Minneapolis. A hospital here wants help in starting a pilot program. But when hospitals find out that there is no Medicare reimbursement for the many hours doctors spend having these conversations, Hammes says it's a hard sell.
Doctors get paid for treatments, for interventions, for diagnoses. I think they should also get paid for conversations. Conversations that actually help people make better decisions about what's good for themselves.
Gunderson Lutheran has been an advocate for end-of-life care at the national level. They even lobbied Congress for it. And last fall, one of their hospital administrators testified on Capitol Hill in front of the Senate Special Committee on Aging.
Professionals had the training to know how to comply with a patient's wishes.
So, Hammes was pleased when the provision to pay for these conversations was added into the House bill. But after the uproar over death panels, the White House signaled they might drop it altogether.
Do you think Americans are really prepared philosophically to go to where you want to take them?
I don't know. I really don't. The kinds of changes that are being proposed are, I think, in many minds, enormous. And we may have to take change at a slower pace.
It may take more time for the rest of the United States to embrace these conversations. But Sue Hessel believes that we need to be more out in the open about these issues. She's even writing about it on her blog.
I think writing about it, talking about it, and reaching out to people and having them reach out to me has really helped me a lot.
So your perspective right now is you're going to fight to live.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Hard.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I throw the kitchen sink at me. I want to be here to see future grandchildren. I want to be around because life is too much fun not to be around.
It's kind of low getting in.
And as for Holly Coleman, he's realistic about his prognosis, so he's going to live it up while he still can.
I know that with my cancer, I'm not going to live all that much longer, but I figure while I'm alive and I'm able to do it, I'm in shape to do it, well, I just have fun. And that's why I bought this little car, to have fun.
When I see him driving up in his little sports car, he's living his life, knowing that there aren't going to be the overall surprises at the end. There's going to be difficult times. We're not stupid. But when it gets to that point, we'll have a plan.